Who are you?
Tim Callender.
Summer Brooks.
Brett Filipek.
We host the Babylon podcast.
What do you want?
To study and discuss the Babylon 5 universe.
Where are you going?
To discover every scrap of B5 memorabilia.
Who do you serve, and who do you trust?
Ah, yes, more Babylon Podcast. I'm Summer Brooks.
I am still Tim Callender. I'm still something.
And we are without Brett because he's being a good dad and attending his daughter's play.
Yeah, that's a good thing. We're pleased for him. Believe it or not, he shows some responsibility, so I guess we'll feel good for him.
One of us has to have responsibilities, right?
Yeah, and it might as well be the person not here.
I'm not going to say anything. I'm not.
In the midst of some of the quote-unquote JMS news that we announced in the last episode, something that we overlooked is apparently there's some sort of return of Captain Power and the Soldiers of the Future.
Captain Power returns.
Yes, we don't know whether that means there's a DVD set coming out or what it quite means, but
well,
there it is.
The video seemed to imply that there was a project for a new Captain Power. Not sure yet whether or not that was a new movie, a new series, a continuation from where the previous series left off. But the video, if you look at the video, JMS is on it talking about it. Mark Scott Zachary is on there.
Yeah.
And some people...
The guy who wrote Napoleon Dynamite?
The company involved is Urban Archipelago Films, who produced the film Ray Bradbury's Chrysalis. So, while I cannot say anything yet, yes, I will be the first to know when they can.
Oh.
They're like, sure.
Summer has ways of making them talk.
Ah, more like old friends.
Oh, there you go.
Like, hey, can you talk about this yet? No, but I'll put you on my list of tall first. Sweet.
Now I have a confession to make. When it was aired, I think I watched maybe 10 minutes of an episode, and knowing that the whole gimmick was that you had to buy the Mattel Captain Power blaster to shoot the bad guys on the screen or something, I never got into it. I watched it. It was one meh. The irony is that I really liked, about that same time, the Transformers Beast Wars was on, which was one of the first CG animated shows. And that had Larry DiTillio writing for that. So, didn't do the JMS thing, but I did the Larry DiTillio, so I got the pre-Babylon 5 experience, as it were.
Okay.
So there you are. So how about you, Summer? Any great Captain Power memories?
No, because I think I only caught maybe one or two episodes before it disappeared. So it was on and off my radar really, really, really quickly. And it wasn't until much later that I was like, wait, I remember that. That was around for how long? I had no idea it had been around for a whole season when all I caught were like two episodes.
Right.
So I would like to come to the series fresh. So if they do make a DVD release of the original series, I'll definitely take a look at it. And then watching what happens with this new project, I'm curious to see where it'll go.
Well, we'll know soon enough, I'm sure.
Cool.
All right. Well, it is Feedback-a-Palooza night.
It is. And Jason is still teasing me about Crusade books, damn it. Anyway, we shall get to those in good time. So we'll take a really quick break and get on to the voicemails.
So, you're still hanging on to that tiny thread of denial, trying to convince yourself that sci-fi has nothing whatsoever to do with your life. Well, you better think again, Sparky. That tiny cell phone has no basis in Starfleet communicators. Those hands-free earpieces now used by virtually everybody didn't come down from the ear of Lieutenant Uhura. And that cute little Rumba vacuum cleaner that you use far too infrequently wasn't hijacked off an Imperial Star Cruiser. Nah, not a chance. Because if it were true, then you would be forced to turn on that Flash Gordon-inspired box on your desk called a computer and listen to SliceOfSciFi.com, the podcast and XM satellite radio show that will turn your sci-fi into reality.
Voicemails, voicemails. Who's got the voicemails?
Well, Mike does. And I feel kind of compelled to say that I sort of dropped the ball. And we can't vouch for... Well, let me rephrase that. Mike has not had the opportunity to do his usual bang-up job on that. So if these sound bad, blame me and not Mike.
Hello, Babcasters. It's Edmund from Greenville. I saw some speculation over in the chat room about whether Agent 6 and this new Adam from Bureau 13 might team up, and it took a bit of doing, but I did get word to him, and Agent 6 insists that this guy must be running a rogue operation. We all know that Bureau 13 lost its official sanction after the Abel Horn fiasco, so naturally he can have nothing to do with them, and it's going to take a lot more than that to lure him out of retirement. You know, he still won't tell anyone why he resigned, but I have heard that those Orion 7 slave girls are extremely talented. Of course, in the B5 universe, they do have more of a purplish hue. Be seeing you.
As we know, with all secret government Black Ops projects, you decommission one and another one pops up right behind it, sometimes with the same people, you know, the ones who didn't die in the first one. So I'm not buying it. Bureau 13 became Bureau 13B for all we know.
Yeah, right. 13.5 or, yeah.
Hey, Babcast. Adam from Bureau 13 again. And so, while everyone else has been sending in their top 5 favorite episodes, I'm going to share my 5 least favorite episodes. Shake up the snow globe a little bit. 1. A View from the Gallery. You have the two underlings that are like, oh, everybody picks on us, and everybody is always using us, and blah, blah, blah. 2. Exogenesis. While the idea of the living recorders is actually a very novel idea, you do have the, oh, they're crazy in that. Why are they crazy? They have bugs living in their back. And that wasn't very good. 3, infection. Obvious reasons. It's the Star Trek. Oh, look at this. We found something that's organic. Oh, no, it turned him into a super soldier. Ah, run! Here, I'll do a Captain Kirk and just talk it into self-destructing itself. Well, and then you have 4, Mind War. I'm the person who's turning to the beam of light, and I've got powers beyond belief. And 5, The Long Dark. I got ditched by my friend, so I'm going to hop a ride in this ship. Nobody's alive in there, so I could just eat their guts out of that, and there's going to be the guy on the station who just happens to know I'm there because his gut is in my belly. Yeah, so I'm sorry, but those are just terrible, terrible, terrible. But yeah, have a good one. Bye.
Wow.
You know, I'm mostly with him on that list, except Mind War.
Yeah, Mind. I would actually put Long Dark in there too, just a little bit, but it's on the edge for me. But I can't disagree with him on the first three. Strongly disagree with him on Mind War. Only slightly disagree with him on the Long Dark. But it sounds like he doesn't like the monster movie episodes. What do you think?
Except for View from the Gallery, those are the monster movie episodes. I never thought of it that way, but you're right. Oh, that's funny. It's Long Dark. See, Long Dark for me is redeemed by Dwight Schultz.
And for me, I liked finding out the tidbit, the connection between what that thing was and the page in Jakar's, the Book of Jaquan, about it being one of the primary minions of the Shadows. So that was a very, very powerful creature.
Right.
And it just happened to get destroyed before it got back to Zahadum. So we have no idea what they would have used that thing for if it had made it back home. Right. So that just happened to be a fortuitous, you know, destruction of one of the tools of the Shadows before the war got going.
Right.
So that's where I disagree with it, because that was a crucial piece of Shadow-related information.
Yeah.
It might have been presented better, perhaps, but it was good. It was okay.
Hello, Babylon Podcast. This is Adam of Bureau 13 again. So a couple days ago, I listened to the Deep Geeking on the movie In the Beginning, and at the same time, I watched the movie a second time. And while that wasn't the last, the recent episode that I listened to, it's just one that I wanted to comment on. And I see a bit of inconsistency with the series and the movie. Sheridan twice says in the series, the Minbari are honorable. They do not do surprise attacks. They don't do ambushes. They fight honorably. Well, first off, think of the battle with the Black Star. How did Sheridan even get in that position where he had to use the nukes? Because he was ambushed by the Minbari. They had the Minbari fighter act dead, and they went in, and boom, they opened jump points in their midst. Think about how they fought the humans. Secure an area, wipe out all the soldiers in the area, leave the civilians, so that way when the war was over, they could go back and wipe them all out. And also think about what they did with ships in distress. They murdered ships in distress. They murdered them, and the few prisoners that did take, Sheridan and Franklin, they were going to interrogate, torture, then kill. There was absolutely no honor whatsoever to the way the Minbari fought the war. And I don't accept what people have kind of commented on about how it might have been the Shadow influence over the warrior caste, which people have said before. Because think of it, as soon as the Great Council was dissolved, the warrior caste immediately, well, not immediately, but as soon as they possibly could, they started casting out the religious caste out of the cities. We hear of, in lines of communication, I think it's lines of communication, where you hear of the religious caste in the polar regions, the warrior caste were casting them out of their cities and making them walk through the snow. This for me, sheds a light on something, a darker part of the Minbari psychic, especially with the warrior caste. But that's just my opinion, and I would like to hear what you guys think on that. You guys have a good one. Bye.
Okay.
Well, as far as the honorable thing, it wasn't Sheridan that said that. It was Sinclair who said that. I think he was referring to, if memory serves, that was the conversation out of Midnight at the firing on the firing line, where the Narn open up jump points and they decimate Ragash 3.
Right.
And so Sinclair's comment was that the Minbari wouldn't just strike dishonorably like that. They wouldn't just show up and start attacking.
Right.
You know, everything else that Adam's talking about is in the midst of a shooting war.
But they never, if I remember correctly, all of their attacks were straight up, because that's how the warrior caste wanted to prove they were the better warrior. They want you to see them coming, and they're still going to kick your ass no matter what you do.
Right. Even the incident in the beginning where Ganya Ivanov goes after that Minbari flyer that turns out to, you know, that's just a ruse. You could argue that that's a trick play, if you will, and the Minbari can say, well, if you fell for it, you're stupid and you deserve what you got coming to you. You know, but yes, I agree with you. At that point, it's still a straight up fight. It's not as though you're at a moment of peace, and that, you know, if anything, from their point of view, the humans acted dishonorably.
Right. And that flyer wasn't sending out a distress call. It was just there.
Right.
It was just there going, la di da di da, look at me. I'm Little Red Riding Hood chasing through the woods by myself. I hope you don't see the 14 dragons I have behind the trees there.
Yeah, right, exactly.
There's nothing dishonorable about that. Now, if he had been sending out a distress signal to lure them in, sure. But this was I'm pretending to be alone so we can just smack down, you know, throw a smack.
Right.
Nothing dishonorable about that. As for there being a shadow influence with the warrior caste, I don't believe that ever happened. We had two different things. We have the one faction of the warrior caste who, shall we say, gave aid and support to a well-known war criminal in Deathwalker. And it was one of the religious caste who aligned themselves with the Drac at the end there, out of desperation because of what the warrior caste had done to their people. But this was after the Shadow War. This was way after the Shadow War.
Yes, exactly.
When this has happened. And so it wasn't shadow influence that drove that. The driving tactics, the urge to wipe out the humans, that was rage-driven grief because these impudent humans killed their leader.
Right.
Like they said, Delenn said, what, it was we went mad together.
Yes.
And we woke up together. A whole entire race, a whole entire culture, a whole entire species went insane with grief because of this great affront at killing their leader for no reason whatsoever. And they were going to exact, you know, 10 eyes for an eye for that. Adam, you've been inside the cloistered Bureau 13 offices too long and you need to get out more.
Yes.
Hello, Babylon Podcast. It is Adam of Bureau 13 again. So, Summer has said many times she would like to know why fan fiction, especially fan films, have not been produced in great quantities, if at all. On fanfiction.net, there are only 1,317 stories on there. That is nothing compared to the 18,831 Star Trek stories or the 26,080 Star Wars stories on there, although it did have 200 more stories than DS9. But the reason is quite simple, actually. JMS has demanded B5 fanfiction to either be clearly labeled as such or kept off the internet, and many websites that have had B5 fanfic have been shut down by the great beast Warner Brothers. So, obviously, fans aren't comfortable posting fanfic due to the almost anti fanfic stance JMS and Warner Brothers have. But for your information, I am working on fanfiction myself, a story called Dreams of Fire, which is how I think the Prince Ventari blowing up New York City prophecy would have turned out, since we know JMS has said that it would come to pass, but in an unexpected way. Then a bunch of stories which I think are going to be pretty good, and if you guys ever want to see it, all you have to do is to say so. But yeah. So I just want to hear what you guys' thoughts are on it. Bye.
Summer, you're more the fanfic person than me. I generally don't go looking for that.
Well, I don't either. I was just, no, normally I was more talking more about the fan film.
Yeah,
thing.
Right.
It's like the only, like I said, Voices of Babylon, only audio drama I've heard of. Never seen any fan films. Not even, well, I guess the parody fan videos kind of counts as fan content. But how many fan-made Star Wars and Star Trek films are there out there?
Yes.
I'm talking major lots. Projects with funding.
Right.
So, yeah. I don't know.
Well, just have to get Margene involved.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'm torn. I don't know if I want to see more or if I just want to hang on and wait for JMS to give us more. Or hopefully he bequeaths to several well-known sci-fi writers the right to write more novels in his universe. I don't know. That wishful thinking on my part.
Hey, Babcasters, it's Harkle. Listening to the Tangent Palooza episode. And actually, that one caller was right about Crusade being canned before it even aired. Because, I mean, I'd actually forgotten this until he brought it up. But I still lived with both my dad and my grandmother at the time. The three of us and some other relatives were sharing a house. And pretty much all of us, except for, like, my uncle and one of my cousins, were all into B5. And, you know, when our schedules would allow it, we'd even watch it together. But I remember before Crusade came on, we were excited about it because we'd like the call to arms, the bad music aside. I'm sorry, I just don't like Evan Chen's work. And we'd read about, and we heard about this because my dad actually worked for a cable company at the time, so he got some sort of insider info. But we knew that it was just going to be the 13 episodes. TNT was going to air 13 episodes of, you know, JMS's new series, and they weren't going to produce anymore. And we recall being really upset about it. It's like, because it's like, it's like, I haven't even aired yet. Why are they canceling it? So it's like, so TNT really actually beats Fox on that level, I think. But, I mean, granted, I could be remembering wrong. But I'm pretty sure that Crusade had already been given the heave-ho before they aired episode one, before they aired Warzone. So, and, yeah, we were not happy about that. But, yeah, I'm pretty sure that the caller was right. So, sorry, I'm rambling. it's just I got no freaking sleep last night, and I have no idea what the hell I'm doing or even where I am right now. All right, talk to you later. Bye.
What does Jason have to say out on the feed?
You don't want to know.
Okay.
I don't. I'm not sure. Never mind.
What? Go on. Don't never mind me.
I'm not sure where he was going with that, or if he ever got to where he thought he was going to go with that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I can really answer. And Jason and I are arguing about nothing Babylon 5 related at all.
All right. Well, never mind then. Roll the next one.
Hello, Babylon Podcast. This is Adam of Bureau 13 again. And I wanted to make a comment on in the beginning. And when you were deep geeking in the beginning, you were talking about how the story that Sheridan told Ivanova about us destroying the Black Star and the story that we see in the beginning were two different versions. One was the simple but bold strategy, and the other one was the act of desperation. I personally can accept the two versions as being true. First off, Lana was telling the story secondhand 30 years in the future. The story obviously wouldn't have had a perfectly accurate account of the event. And second, Sheridan was telling Ivanova 12 years after the conflict, and time does distort memory of events, sometimes making one's position and the event better or worse. So indeed, from his point of view, it happened that way, and I can accept that. Anyways, that's all I wanted to say, and have a good one.
You know, here's my take on that from like within the universe. I can kind of get that. But the idea is that you're telling the story. And this is supposed to be how people know the story. And you've got two different versions of the story, and in my mind, they're kind of in conflict. I don't know.
Okay.
This really is it. I like Sheridan's recounting of it better in terms of the fact that it indicates the kind of desperation that humanity faced in this war, that they would stoop to dishonor for survival. Whereas the way it's told in the beginning, it becomes justifiable because of self-defense.
That's the contradiction you're talking about. Okay.
Right. Right. And to me, that makes the telling of it in Points of Departure is more compelling because it gives a level of complexity to Sheridan's character that takes him beyond the usual good guy, heroic captain. And I like that. And in the beginning, it takes that away. It's the standard run of the mill. The bad guys have us. So justify it in doing what we have to do.
Okay. Yeah. I see what you're talking about, because in the beginning kind of diminishes the impact of what he was saying. Remember, what was it? I'm drawing a blank on the episode when Ivanova.
Yeah. Points of Departure.
Yeah. We were talking about the piece of the Black Star, and he's like, I'm not going to apologize for it. You know, this the way he's like,
yeah, it was the only real victory we had.
Yeah. And just the fire, the passion he had about it. He's like, it's not a sneak attack. It's not this. We were trying to survive, and damn it, I'm not going to apologize for it. Yeah. In the beginning kind of diminishes that.
Yes. Right. Right. And that's a storytelling thing. And to me, that's what's, it's kind of like you can't have your cake and eat it too. One of the underlying premises of Babylon 5 as a show was that it was all about the story and telling us the story in ways we've never seen the story told. And then to come along and change that story, and then to suggest that, oh, well, it's because this character doesn't know the real story, so he's telling it from his interpretation, to me it's kind of retconning, and it's kind of dishonest is a little strong, but it's just not. Yeah, it diminishes the power of the original. So there you are.
Yep.
Okay.
And Jason is teasing me. He quote says, I have a script on my desk. Dun, dun, dun. And he's not even going to tell me who it's by. But it's for Other Voices Volume 2.
Well, we know it's not Margene Holden's.
I know. I think Jason ought to email her and get her Crusade script from her.
There you go. Mm-hmm. All right, next voicemail.
Hello, Babylon Podcast. This is Adam of Bureau 13 again. So anyways, I listened to the other day to your episode on surprises. What surprised you about B5 as you watched it? And something that was both a great surprise but also a gripe upon later examination for me was the discoverance of Sinclair being Valen. When I first watched the series and we see the two Minbari go on board to B4, pistols in hand, Zasaris leads him to the room and we see two Vorlons out of their suits flanking Sinclair, and he holds up his hands and says, I am Valen. That was an awesome moment. Made more awesome from that scene in Passing Through Gethsemane with my brother Edward says, I would like to learn more about Valen, and Lanier just begins to ramble on about him until the lens like, hold up there, Buck. But when I saw that moment, I'm like, holy crap! And they wanted to kill him if he found out? Crazy! Then watching it my second time through, I actually thought about it, and I'm like, wait, they wanted to kill him? He's Valen, for crying out loud. The greatest of them all. But if Valen was so great, why would they want to kill him? You see, from even the gathering, factions of the Minbari trying to discredit to Sinclair, and sometimes even trying to kill him. Then there is that scene of in Sky Full of Stars where that member of the Great Council tells Lin if he remembers what happened at the Battle of the Line to kill him. And that really bugged me until I remembered a line from Believers. The two parents are trying to implore Delenn to represent them, and she says, "We have had our religion tampered with before, and we have vowed to never let that happen." We know that Balin made the caste system, and perhaps religion played a much bigger role in the lives of Minbari until he showed up and separated it into its own separate caste. And with that in mind, perhaps the Great Council did not want Sinclair to go back in time to become Balin, which was the whole disruptive force of the religion in the first place. And let's face it, he's human, and that in itself is a great insult to the Minbari. But anyways, just would like to hear your thoughts on that, about that. And have a good one. Bye.
Well,
No,
go ahead.
I was going to say, Adam's overlooking the point that the Minbari, the Great Council, did not know that Sinclair was Valen. Where they were coming from and where they felt his life was potentially forfeit is the concept that he had a Minbari soul inside of him, and the whole concept that Minbari souls were migrating to humans. And it wasn't that he was Valen. They didn't know that. Nobody knew that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That was... The Great Council had no idea he was going to travel back in time and actually be Valen. They had known for a while, according to what Lanier had said, that lesser souls, the greater Minbari souls, were going elsewhere, not being reborn into succeeding generations, and they didn't know where they were going until they interrogated Sinclair and discovered, OMG, he's got Valen's soul. And then they pulled in other pilots and found that some of them had Minbari souls.
Right.
And that's what caused the surrender. So it's not like the Great Council knew that there was going to be time travel. I don't think anybody knew there was going to be time travel until, Drawl started showing stuff to Delenn after he got there, right?
Yes.
So the Great Council had no knowledge of this. I'm pretty sure she didn't tell the Great Council about it because she was... kind of on the outs with them by then.
Just right?
A teensy bit. So that's not the time travel thing. What I think might have been was after the war was over, you turn your eyes back to internal struggles. It could have been just simply a political power thing.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't know where he came from, and they didn't want him having too much power over the Minbari going forward. I got the impression that the Minbari having their religion meddled with went back much, much further, like 1,000 years before that.
Right. Agreed.
So, yeah, that's what I think.
And it might also, you know, it's never explicitly mentioned, but it may be a certain awareness that the Vorlons might have had something to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but that's pure conjecture on my part.
Yeah. Jason is saying Kosh knew that there was a time travel incident.
Yeah, but Kosh knew all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And Jason and Neil are also saying that they absolutely love what you said about in the beginning.
Thank you, guys.
They're on your side. They got you back.
Yay.
Hey, Babcasters. It's Oracle. Still listening to the Tangent Palooza episode regarding, you know, the two directors that Summer does not want to hear attached to repent Harlequin. I really, really hate to defend that sanctimonious prick, Uwe Boll, but in this one instance, I must. You see, his non-video game movie, not plural, I mean singular, as in so far as I know, he's only made one movie that was not based on a video game, but that movie, a movie called Tunnel Rats about World War I, was actually pretty good. I mean, granted, it's possible that it only seems really good when you put it up against Seed, Alone in the Dark, Far Cry, and all those other horrible, horrible movies that just seeing clips of causes my brain to bleed. But, but you know, since Repent Harlequin isn't a video game, Just saying.
But it also sounds like Tunnel Rats was a historical drama and not science fiction. So based on what I've seen, Uwe Boll should be kept very, very far away from anything speculative fiction, be it sci-fi, horror, or what have you. He should be wearing a shock collar that electrocutes him every time someone even walks near him with a science fiction script. Just have some random assistant tase him if he like reaches for a science fiction story at all, ever. not buying it. Maybe his true calling lies in doing historical period pieces or something, but keep him out of my sci-fi.
Yeah, and you know what? I'll be very surprised if that film actually gets made.
I hope it gets made, just not with those two.
Hey, Babcast, this is Adam of the Bureau again. So, I have two questions. First, why was B5 blown up by the Earth Alliance? In episode 1 of season 5 of B5, Sheridan was talking about how they were working on buying the station from the EA. If he and the ISA bought B5, I very highly doubt he would have blown it up. So, did he fail at buying it, despite the official story being it was a hazard to space travel? Which, even my first time watching, I went, yeah, right. I'm pretty sure space is a little bit bigger than that. Was it perhaps a statement from factions of the EA that were opposed to the ISA? After all, B5 was the most iconic symbol of the ISA. And my second question is, isn't the Excalibur an ISA ship only made the way it was for the familiarity human soldiers would have with the controls? I'm pretty sure Sheridan said something to the effect of that during Call to Arms. So why in Crusade is the Excalibur called an Earth Alliance ship? Was it given to the Earth Alliance for keeps? I'm just wondering. I haven't gotten around to watching Crusade a second time, or even a Call to Arms, but I'm just wondering if I was right, wrong, or if there was an explanation why or whatnot. But anyways, have a good one. Bye.
I agree with some of what Adam's saying. I think the destruction of Babylon 5 was a propaganda ploy. I don't think it... Menace to navigation. It's an orbit around a planet that's pretty much abandoned. It's not like people are going there for the hot springs or the food.
It could have drifted into the jump gate. Come on. no.
Shenanigans.
Regarding his actual question, at the end of season 5, I believe that the Interstellar Alliance was purchasing Babylon 5 from Earth Alliance. But I believe it was mentioned that they sold it back to them for a pittance later on. I don't know where I'm getting that from, but I could swear that was in there. It's like that, yeah, they sold it back and now they're just decommissioning it. As for, what was his second question again?
The Excalibur. Right, Excalibur, yeah.
I believe the Interstellar Alliance turned over control of it to Earth Alliance because of the need to have an advanced vessel searching for the plague. I don't know if that was actually ever officially stated.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
But it's definitely implied. I could be wrong. Jason? Not quick enough. But no, I am going to go back and look for that source, but I'm pretty sure that it was implied but not stated that the Interstellar Alliance bequeathed that ship to the Earth Alliance. But I know that there was a source someplace. It might have been in Sleeping in Light. It might have been before. No, it had to have been in Sleeping in Light, where they mentioned that the ISA had sold Babylon 5 back to Earth Alliance.
Okay.
Hi, this is Joe Carfley. I had sent the email about the Babylon 5 top 5, and apparently I get a freebie, so I'm going to take Chrysalis. And the reason is that same thing for Zaha Doom. I believe without those season finales, we want to be talking about B5 going 5 years. Chrysalis is ending is amazing, and I think with all the tension involved and all the unanswered questions, we don't get season 2. And I like Zaha Doom better because I do believe that Zaha Doom is probably next to maybe Best of Both Worlds and maybe Who Shot JR, the greatest season finale of all time. I think everything else, even in the shadow of Zaha Doom, I think we would eventually have gotten to that point, maybe a little bit later. But Zaha Doom to me with Sheridan maybe dying, Garibaldi, the shadows at B5, come on. That is, you know, that is the greatest sequence ever, and Jakar's speech at the end. You can't beat that. So, like again, I said, Tim, when I commented, I would love to do a Star Trek Next Gen with you because I think summer lets you off a little bit too easy at times, and I think we'd have a lot of fun. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Summer lets me off easy.
So, bow!
I don't even know what that means.
He's offering to step in with a bigger stick and lay down the smackdown that I have been apparently in his eyes remiss in dealing with.
Yeah, but for Next Gen, come on. That's a whole other podcast.
Everybody says that Next Gen doesn't even get good until season 3 or season 4, right?
Oh, I agree. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no doubt.
Oh, that cracks me up.
Hey, Babcast, this is Adam of Bureau 13 again. So, I have a story I would like to tell. Understand now, only one person I know even knew about Babylon 5 before I discovered it, and the only way I know that they know is because I posted my status on Facebook one day, "We live for the one, we die for the one," and she responded with the next line of the Ranger mantra. And my family was at the point that I once said in a conversation the name Babylon 5 last year, and my married sister said, "What's Babylon 5?" But I've tried to help them see the error in their ways, but am not winning that battle by a long shot. For example, the other day, I was watching the episode Epiphanies where Zaha Doom blows up, and my dad walks in my bedroom, which he only does when I am in trouble. However, he told me he was just there to see what I was watching. I told him what season the episode was in and that it would take forever to explain what was going on, but I decided to just give basic descriptions of the people. Like Sheridan, he's a captain and he died and came back. But he didn't even last until the blowing up of Zaha Doom before he stood up and walked out saying, "Remember, I was watching Star Trek way before you were even born." So I tried to tell him something that was totally unlike Star Trek to get him hooked. So what did I tell him? Londo trying to cheat on poker using his six, of course. And now my dad is very concerned about the shows I watch and hasn't been drawn in, but totally turned off towards the show. You could say that was a bad move on my part, and I'll admit it. But yeah, I just thought I'd share that with you guys, and have a good one.
Yeah, I have to be careful with what you introduce people with. I don't care whether it's Babylon 5, Star Trek, or whatever. Yeah.
How can you, if you want to attract the attention of someone who likes sci-fi but has a short attention span, I would actually start with Severed Dreams.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would actually start with Severed Dreams.
I would maybe start with The Coming of Shadows.
Mm. So
I think there's a lot of cool stuff that goes on in that one.
I don't know. I still think for the, you know, for your, maybe for someone older, that would work. Someone who's used to more smart sci-fi, but someone who's, you know.
Oh, right.
Video game attention. Yeah, video game attention spans, severed dreams I'd go with. Yeah, if you're going with somebody who's used to the older, smarter, more cerebral sci-fi movies from the 60s and 70s, or the older, especially someone who likes the original Outer Limits,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I could see Coming of Shadows being used to right. lure them in with the right. intrigue they're in.
Yes, I got you. I understand your distinction there.
That's what we should do. We should have a we should send out a question to our fans for generational sci-fi fans. Which episode would you use for teenagers? What episode would you use for someone in their 20s and 30s? What episode would you use for somebody in their 50s and 60s? Talk amongst yourselves. Get back to us.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And we're going to take a really quick break and wrap up this. I'm going to have to call this Adamapalooza, because did anybody else leave a voicemail besides Adam in there?
Yeah, we had a few, but not many.
Bob Nerdly is a real Geico insurance customer, not an actor. To help him with his message, we've hired professional voice actor John Bell.
I was having problems downloading my podcast.
In a world where critical information has to get through.
I went to chuckchat.com and clicked on TechNrum and gave it a listen. Tech, science, sci-fi interviews, it was great.
A new wind was beginning to blow.
Chuck and Craig are funny, informative. I don't know what I would have done without them.
In the fight for justice, two men stood up to help those in need.
Geico Insurance. Only available by listening to Technorama at chuckchat.com.
Feed your inner geek. My throat is starting to hurt.
All right, wrapping things up.
Yeah, we got an email here.
Okay. Well, first
this comes to us. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, real quick. We got confirmation from Neil and Bowie. There was a line in Sleeping in Light, quote, since this place was turned back to Earth Control a few years ago. Apparently, it may have been edited out of the TNT airing, perhaps, possibly.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to have to go back and watch it again and try to pay attention, because the problem is when I watch that episode, I get caught up in it every time.
Yeah. Understood.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Neil, for that. We appreciate that. Okay. This is an email. This comes to us from Adam in Bureau 13. He writes, Summer made comment about the nature of forgiveness. Oh, this is, he titles us my take on the path of sorrows. Says, Summer made comment about the nature of forgiveness. How, she asked, can a stranger forgive someone? First off, philosophers, holy men, and fanatics have been trying to ascertain the nature of God and such things as forgiveness since man first looked up to the stars and asked himself, how did those lightning bugs get stuck up there? But let me relate an experience I had 3 years ago. I was a missionary serving my religion in good old Denver. It was a hot summer day, and I was walking with another missionary, and out of a car jumped two middle-aged women who gave us two Gatorade bottles, then jumped back into the car and drove away. On those bottles were small personalized cards with flowers that were smiling and said, a good deed to brighten your day. Despite the fact I didn't even have time to thank those people, and they were total strangers who I never saw again, it made my day on an otherwise hot and dry day. Now, for someone to do something nice for you, they have to make the effort. Even if they say they forgive you, they go out of their way to say it. Is it not possible, then, that the simple fact that the creature told the crew in turn, I forgive you, is that enough? Didn't it put their minds at ease? They needed to be told by someone else they were forgiven, because it wasn't in their own power to forgive themselves. After all, isn't it the thought that counts? Also, isn't it simply possible that Summer is thinking too deeply into the matter? Would she have accepted it better if he had damned them for what they had done? By Summer's line of reasoning, a killer can't kill someone who is a stranger to them, because why would he kill someone he doesn't know? Now, don't get me wrong, I like Summer, but I guess I can't understand why the creature forgiving them is such a problem for her. All right, Summer, ball's in your court.
I had actually made some notes about what it was exactly that I found wrong that didn't sit right with me for that, and I misplaced them. So I'm going to make an effort to recover those, and I will.
Yes, please.
I will put it on the website as a post for people to comment on, because I know that one particular sticking point for me raised a whole lot of eyebrows that I didn't expect to be raised. And random acts of kindness is vastly different from, you know, kindness of strangers doesn't extend to, oh, I forgive you for, you know, murdering that child 10 years ago. Duh, what? Right. Huh? Yeah. I don't get it. So, yeah.
Well, the thing I would point out here is the difference there is not that what Matheson and Gideon and Galen were being offered forgiveness for wasn't their, it wasn't anything specifically that they had done. It wasn't an action that caused someone harm. It was their guilt over some incident that had happened that they wonder, could it have been done something different? Could I have done something different? Should
right,
I
and
have
that, done that something sort different? Of that sort of self-blame can only be absolved when the person feeling it allows themselves to forgive themselves. Now,
sure,
if the creature had said something different, if you know, I forgive you for being an idiot, for surviving, right. for the, it's like you're taking their power away from them to heal themselves. That's what I have a problem with. Now, if the creature had said something to the effect of, I believe in you, I believe you have the power to forgive yourself and move on, totally would have been on board with that. Totally.
See,
different.
Yeah, but here's how I would argue that. And you're right. In order for someone to accept that forgiveness, they have to be ready for it. Maybe the thing is that the alien saying, I forgive you, is a shock enough to them that it allows them to accept that and by extension forgive themselves. Because here's the thing. Gideon and Matheson both admit to sleeping better than they have slept in years, which indicates that having the alien proffer forgiveness at least grants them a certain amount of acceptance. So, you know, to be able to say, hey, maybe it's okay. Maybe I can accept that I survived, that what I did might have been the right thing after all. Or even more to the point that it's in the past and dwelling on it in the past does me no good now. By contrast, Galen refuses it, and violently so. So he's not in a place where he can accept that. And oh God, the title escapes me now, but Well Forever, where Gideon and Galen are talking, and they finish up the conversation where Galen says, perhaps we can, you know, both be absolved of our common crime. And Gideon says, well, what's that? And Galen's response is, for being alive. So that need for forgiveness is established there. And in Path of Sorrows, the potential for absolution is granted. And at that point in time, Gideon and Matheson were receptive to it, and Galen wasn't.
And I see it as being a little, I don't know, disingenuous, because it's never, it would have been more effective if the creature had done something to make it more obvious that they accepted being, that they accepted they had the power to forgive themselves, rather than just saying, oh, you're forgiven, by some external creature and just moving on. There's a disconnect there, because there's either a step missing or an implied step that a lot of people might not get, including myself. So If it had been stated slightly differently, it would have made more sense to me. It wouldn't have rubbed me so wrong the first time.
Sure. Well, I understand that. The other thing I would say about it too is that the implication is that it's a permanent change of state. That now that I'm forgiven, I accept that what's happened and I can move forward. I would suggest, knowing how JMS deals with his storytelling, that at some point they may have had to confront those things again to determine whether or not they truly had forgiven themselves or accepted that forgiveness. And of course, we'll have no way of knowing. Well,
okay. Definitely open-ended. I'm sure we'll get more on this. Is that it?
That's it.
Okay, cool.
That's it for this batch. I can promise you that we already have some voicemails piling up. So
excellent. So that'll do it for this episode. As always, the website is BabylonPodcast.com. Come by, check out our other episodes, check out our comments, our polls. We actually probably by now are wrapping up our What Is Your Favorite Lita Episodes poll.
Yes.
For Pat Tallman herself. And yes, we are planning on getting her to come on the show to discuss the results of said poll. Our forums, farpointforums.com, our email address, babylonpodcast@gmail.com. Send that in there and Tim will indulge you with a plethora and amazingly long reply. He just can't when it's words in Babylon 5, he can't stop himself. Yeah. Trust me. We know. And as always, call in your own voicemail. Message, the number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year that we finally got through all that voicemail.
Only to let more pile up. And we'll see you next time on the other side of the gate.